It was 1976, the bicentennial. I was sitting in my sixth grade social studies class at Central Elementary School. Our teacher was telling us that in our lifetime, white males would become a statistical minority in the United States. Now, I don't remember much from elementary school, but I remember this because a feeling of dread washed over me as I imagined how frightened and angry people were going to be. The Census Bureau predicts that the year 2042, that's the year, that will be the pivotal year that my teacher talked about. And we are now living in the middle of all those amazing demographic shifts. We see it every day in the way the products are marketed to us, in the way institutions are changing, and in the way fear is turning to hatred of people who are different. The Browning of America, that's what they're calling it. Religious institutions are right in the middle of the thick of it, including our very own Unitarian Universalist Association. In the past year, our leaders have raised multiculturalism way up to the top of the agenda. And I know that a lot of you have read the essays by our UU ministers, Paul Razor, Rosemary Bray McNatt, and our new president, Peter Morales. Some of them have been sounding the alarm that we must change or risk becoming irrelevant, or even worse, extinct. Here at WUU, we started this conversation in 2008 when the Pew Research Center released its study about religion in America. Reverend Preston Moore highlighted the correlation between the trends in religion and the multicultural shifts that are going on. And then later, a couple of months after that, during Black History Month in 2009, the Reverend Mark Morrison Reed came here. He talked about how Unitarian Universalism and Unitarian Universalist congregations have a particular culture. More than that, he said, ours is an ethnic religion. Do you remember when he said that? Ours is an ethnic religion. So while many UUs enthusiastically support this move toward multiculturalism, there are plenty of others who are feeling a little reluctant. And they're just reflecting the general anxiety that's out there in the American public. Some people are saying, oh, this is just, you know, UUs again trying to be politically correct. And others are saying, oh, it's just about relieving white guilt. Some people are asking, what does any of this have to do with religion anyway? Now, there's a question that I'm interested in. What does our religion ask of us in relation to multiculturalism? Forget what our denomination asks of us. Forget even what our institutional leaders are asking of us. What is our religion asking of us? First of all, as people of faith, we really shouldn't let ourselves get caught up in the whole market share game. Multiculturalism, from a religious perspective, is not about filling up the pews. And it's certainly not about meeting a quota, you know, X number of Asians, X number of 20-something hipsters, X number of families with toddlers. Our religion doesn't ask us to pursue multiculturalism to head off our denominational extinction. If that were the reason that we were doing all of this, then without the demographic shifts, there would be no reason to talk about any of this in the first place, right? But in fact, there has always been a compelling reason to talk about it. And it's always been about religion, not about market share. Howard Thurman pursued a multicultural vision. He called it the interracial church in 1935. Dr. Thurman was in India visiting Gandhi, and there at the Khyber Pass, he had a revelation. After weeks and weeks of interacting with people who were completely different from him, he had a revelation that what needed to happen in America was an interracial church. In his words, this church would be for the weak as well as the strong, for all peoples, whatever their color, whatever their caste. Now, Dr. Thurman was not responding to a socio-demographic movement, but rather a movement of the Spirit. This movement of the Spirit urged him to live his faith, to live his faith. Every kind of institution has a culture, including religious ones. Some institutions have what we might call a monoculture, and others have a multiculture. In congregations, multiculture is essentially, it's essential, that is, to meeting the transcendent values of that community. Multiculture is essential to the transcendent values of that community. And monoculture is actually antithetical to the transcendent values of the community. Now, what is this transcendent value I'm talking about? It's very easy. Our children know it. It's love. Love, the willingness to see another person fully. Love, the willingness to see the essential humanity in another human being. Now, I'm not saying that you can't have love in a spiritual community where all the people are very similar. And I'm not saying that in a multicultural community, everybody's out there loving on each other. What I am saying is that an intentionally multicultural community will present more opportunities to practice seeing deeply and therefore practice loving deeply. In the congregation, when we meet someone who's just like us, we're really happy about that, aren't we? It's easy to see just the culture and the biography of that person. The movies they watch, the neighborhood they live in, the clubs they join, the work they do. It's easy to relate to this person. We have a lot in common. And so what happens a lot is we just play the loop of the tape when we have conversations with them. We can do it with our eyes closed, can't we? Have those kinds of conversations. We don't really have to see the other person because all we're interacting with is biography and culture. Now, in some cases, we've spent years and years relating on this level, that level of culture and that level of biography. And sometimes, very sadly, it's not until their memorial service when we learn something deep about that person. Now, in contrast, the multicultural community, there we are called upon to use and to develop our capacity to see, really, really see the other person. When we encounter someone who's really different from us, that we're not used to, we don't have an easy way out. We don't have these tapes that we can play when we're having a conversation with them. We can't relate on the usual level of culture and biography. And so the opportunity arises to see the essential humanity of the other person. And then the only thing that's left in between and that's common between us is that essential humanity. It's that kind of relating described in the Adrian Rich poem that Anne read so beautifully. Here's the poet sitting at her desk, and she sees her reader. She sees in a way that we're talking about seeing. So I know that this may sound like a really high aspiration to you. When we meet someone who's different, we usually feel a strong urge to run away or jump over a wall, turn away, rather than to suffer the discomfort of a deeper encounter. But isn't resisting that urge to run away exactly what our religion calls us to do? We are asked to live our faith, to turn the principle of inherent worth and dignity into the practice of love and the practice of compassion. There is a particular culture in Unitarian Universalism. The Reverend Rosemary Bray McNatt describes it this way. Many of us brag about not owning a television because there's nothing worth watching unless it's PBS. Most of us are people who refuse to listen to popular music because it's violent. And many of us are unapologetic nature lovers. The only thing we might love more than hiking in the woods is building our buildings in the woods, complete with tiny, elegant signs that blend so well with the natural surroundings that visitors cannot find us in the street. Many of us eat locally. We shop at the farmer's market, and we wouldn't be caught dead in a Walmart unless it was an emergency. Many of us do read ahead in the hymnal to see whether we will agree with the words that we're about to sing. But in doing so, we forget that the person sitting right next to us may need exactly those words that we are refusing to sing. We have a choice here. It's the same choice facing religious communities all over America today, to remain monocultural or to intentionally set out to be multicultural. Not because our organizational existence depends on it, not even because it's the right thing to do, but because our spiritual salvation depends on it. If we don't live out our faith, then what's the point of having one? Some of our neighboring religious communities may not be interested at all in being part of a community other than just a community of like-minded people, right? For people who go to the so-called ethnic churches, the security and the familiarity of a comfortable culture is extremely important. A couple of weeks ago, I had a conversation with an African-American man in town. We were talking about multicultural church, you know, about how Martin Luther King said that 11 o'clock on Sunday is the most segregated hour, and it still is today in 2010. And he said to me, well, I don't think that's a problem at all. This man holds a very high position at a mostly white company. And he said his black church is the only place, apart from his family, where he can relax. It doesn't matter, he told me, that I don't believe anything the pastor says. And, you know, those words could have come out of my father's mouth to describe the way he feels about his church. That's the one I grew up in. In the Korean church, religion was secondary to the social community. The social support was very important for those people who felt otherwise isolated. This was also a place where men, especially the men, could exercise their power. After spending a whole week feeling powerless because their English wasn't quite good or with encounters with racism, the church is where it all came out. Culture and biography is all that they had. There was no transcendent value. There was no common faith in love and compassion, forgiveness, And they spent a lot of time fighting and bickering with each other. Looking around this room, we can see that we are more monoculture than multiculture, and in a variety of different ways. The character of our culture is about more than just race and ethnicity. It's also about education level, about what kind of jobs we hold, how much money we make, where we shop, what we buy, and also how we express our spiritual yearning. The shift from monoculture to multiculture asks us to reflect on how these characteristics might be setting up barriers to people who yearn for our kind of religion. Now, we may look like a community that is defined more by its culture than its transcendent values, but, you know, it's not that important, I don't think, what we look like at this particular moment in our shared history. What matters ultimately is where we are going. Here at WUU, we are devoting our sincerest efforts to cultivating a religious community that lives its faith, that takes its fundamental principles and turns them into practices of love and compassion. Your board has set two priorities for the coming year. One of them is the multicultural community. We've already planned lots of events, and you'll be hearing more about them at these congregational workshops. The first one will begin in a few minutes. And if you miss this one, like Anne said, there's another one in July and another one in August. I know you are listening to this sermon. I know you are listening to this sermon skeptical but willing to stay in the conversation. I know you are listening to this sermon heart swelling with eagerness for this multicultural vision. I know you are listening to this sermon worried about losing something you have cherished for a long time. I know you are listening to this sermon with an ear attuned to the possibilities of a great new opening. May it be so. Amen.